Today is March 27th, 1985. My name is Tika Ward. I'm interviewing Dorothy and Roy Heimerdinger. We're at 938 Hess Lane, Louisville, Kentucky. Our topic is Lou Tate and the Little Loom House. Tell me a little something about yourself.
Well, basically, I'm a woodworker, and it's a sort of an odd thing. My first real job was building pipe organs. And during the Depression, why things changed, and I had to seek other employment. And it was in Gamble Brothers. And then later on, it was with Anderson Woodworking. And in between, I worked for myself for a while. And I end up now being a pipe organ builder. See? So that's the that's a complete cycle. So that's where I stand right now.
Tell me how you first heard of Lou Tate.
Well, I suppose I heard of Lou through Sam Kendrick and Sue Kendrick. Okay, Sam worked with Gamble's, and I worked at Gamble's. And I think, I believe Sam designed the loom. And I think Sam designed that little shuttle that she used. And they made a few looms for Lou. And for some reason or other, they decided not to make them or whatever. I don't understand. And that's how I got in touch with Lou. I said, Lou, would you like for me to make the looms? See? And that's how how the contract was made. So I just worked on and off with Lou ever since on her looms. It's like everything else. I was looking for sort of a sideline. You know what I mean? And not as a, you know, a compulsory thing at all, but just as a way to make a little extra money along the side without any pressure, see? And it worked out pretty good. She was looking for somebody like that too. And so between the two of us, while we were able to get along, she furnished most of the materials. And it's just a matter of mainly of assembly and that sort of thing. And, you know, so it worked out very well.
Did you call her up and make an appointment? Did you just arrive
there?
No,
I just walked out to see her.
What did you think when you first walked, you know, out there? Anything?
It was all brand new to me. I mean, you walked up the top house, and I suppose there must have been 100 looms. Sitting in that top house and all the shelves, all with a different pattern on each loom. And it was quite surprising to figure out how in the world she could sit there and figure out all the different patterns and have all those different looms sitting there. Of course, she taught classes, and I suppose it was a way of demonstrating and showing her students the different things that could be done. But it was very interesting. And the way she operated, I will never understand. You know, it was, she had a system of sharing of some kind. I did understand it. She would have these students come in, and they were supposed to do a certain amount of work around a piece of property to help warp a loom or whatever was required toward the payment of their lesson. It was a sort of a sharing thing. And, of course, she published a paper, a magazine type thing, and that was a remarkable thing in itself, unless, you know, to me it was all algebraic and all sorts of designs, and she sat there with this drawing board and figured all these patterns out, and she was, you know, she had IQ 160 or so, and she was a brilliant person, and she knew history. She could talk about things, the Grecians, or anybody that she wanted to pick out. And, you know, she had a chance to teach as a professor, I think in Chicago, which she turned down. She was not happy with it. You know, she was an independent, self-reliant person. And she did things her way. So that was not for her, see. course, because I remember her father was living. He did a lot of work out there. Helped her, you know, and on the hill. I helped her with her repairing the buildings and keeping in shape and doing one thing another for her. Of course, after his death, why, she lost a good friend. See, when she lost her father. And then she had to make other arrangements. And along the way, I meant to hang the best I could for her. I know one winter, I guess it was, we went out there and I bought a bunch of, what do you call it, the plastic for the windows. And they hung all over the windows in the little loom house that they put it, you know, at the bottom of the hill. And we did a lot of things for it. And she always she appreciated. I built shelves for it, and so you had that room where she lived. And I went out and she burnt oil, and that got to be a burden. She couldn't handle it. See. So she asked about buy an electric stove, so I went out and bought an electric stove. And she had 220 put in the house, and she liked it so well, I had to go out and buy her another one, you know. I think I took her to the library, you know, and just all kinds of things, just to be helpful. She was honest as the day is long. I mean, she was just a solid citizen. While she was in the nursing home, she helped crisis with the people in the nursing home, taught them how to weave. And she couldn't, she got to the point, you know, she was used to being in that cabin. That was home. And that's where she wanted to be. And she had terminal cancer, and she couldn't get over it, and she knew it. So she wanted to die in a cabin. See, that was the story. And so I think I went over to the nursing home and got her and took her to the cabin and did some things for her, and that's where she died, I guess. Oh, she ended up in the hospital. That's right. Mm-hmm. She ended up at Norton's, Jewish, one of the two. And, that was a, you know, sad story. But, anyhow, she was a very brave person to the very end. She was her own person, in every respect. She held classes all the time for school children. I mean, they'd come out in a bus, you know, and up on that hill. And that was one of her prides and joy. Was to teach the children and see them progress, and see them pick up the mechanics of, you know, of weaving, and the children got a lot of good out of it. There was therapeutic advantage there. You know, they she went to Fort Knox also. And had classes for the soldier boys during the war. In fact, we were out there one time with her. So she taught at the University of Louisville, I think. I think Ursuline College, I'm not dead certain. But she made herself known all around the city, and she did a lot of good.
Did you ever get to watch her with the children?
Yes, oh yeah. And she was very genteel with them, you know, and encouraged them. And just got a big kick out of watching them work. She really did.
As you and she worked on the looms, tell me about the looms. What kind of wood you used?
Well, they were all hard white maple, mainly. And
why did you choose that kind?
Well, it's a very durable wood, and it'll take a lot of knocks and dents and rough handling, you know, and they stood up very well. You know, make my piece of pine while they fall apart. Of course, I made quite a few improvements on that loom with Lou's approval. See, originally they were put together with dowels, I never did think it was too satisfactory, so I blew the bells. So I wanted to put the square strips around the edges and screws to hold them in, everything in place. And that made a real solid square frame. And she really liked that. And, well, just a few things. And she supplied all the heater frames. And of course, she put on the heddles herself when she wore up the looms. And, well, see, it had to be a, it had to be a quite a precision job on the loom, because when they put the roller in the front and the roller in the back and they started that around, it had to roll straight. If it rolled, if it was sitting there on the angle, I'd pull, but it had to be quite accurate, so when they wore up, they'd have a straight piece of goods come out the back end. They wouldn't, you know, be all buckled up and wrinkled, that sort of thing. So it was a pretty good job.
What about the bench and the table and the treadles?
Well, I made some benches for her, and also made some tables. In fact, I would take her down to some of the woodworking plants in the city and introduce her to these fellas, and then she'd explain to them what she wanted, see, and then they'd furnish the lumber for her. I think they did that with, I think Anderson supplied some material for her. I think Gamble supplied material for her. And there was a place down on 12th Street, I can't remember the name of the company, also supplied material for her. And Weiss Metalworks down on Hill Street supplied some metal parts for her. And so in other words, I helped her find suppliers for her stuff, and also she used a spring, you know, when she had to separate the thread, and you had to have a spring, and in the pedals you push one and the spring pull it back up, and I think I got somebody in town to buy the springs for her, the kind of spring she wanted, because she wasn't, you know, couldn't understand all that stuff, so kind of helpful with in that respect. She paid her bills all the time, no problem. So she knew how to handle the little loom house. I never did understand it, but she understood it. And that was the main thing. Well, go ahead and say whatever you want to say.
Well, one of the nicest things we had at the loom house from time to time would be a party. And if you ever saw the interior of the loom house, the tables were the work tables. And everything was pushed back, and the loom tables were put up here, and she often made them...
potato soup.
Some yeah. sort of soup, and put it in a huge tureen, great big gorgeous tureen.
Oh yeah, that big bowl.
And she'd have salad and all sorts.
She'd have 15 people there, you know.
And everybody would be sitting at a different level. You know, up here, or down there, or scooched over here, or kind of like this. There was no uniformity there. And it was very informal. And she had the coffee in the back of her, and she'd reach back. And the silver was lovely. It was her mother's silver. And lovely china. The soup tureen, I think, was one I remember especially. And it was all very informal. And she'd lay, she'd wash her face and comb her hair down, put on a clean dress, and she was ready to go.
What would the occasion be? I understand there were birthday parties.
Yes, it would be a birthday party now.
Each Christmas, that was a special season for her. She'd have everybody out sometime during the Christmas season.
During the holidays.
Mm-hmm. And she'd have it decorated as best she could, you know, and she'd sit them all down to a nice, well, whatever she had, and they all had a good time. Had that great big fireplace, in that house, and she'd have a big fire in there, you know, and it was nice and cozy.
And sometimes you could just take the table scraps and put them on the fire.
Yeah.
Informality was the word.
That's right.
who were some of the people who would be there with you all?
Oh, I can't remember those names. I can't remember.
A couple of retired teachers.
Sisters. Yes, there were. There were. Oh, there were some quite influential people were members of that group. But as far as calling any names, I just couldn't do it, Donnie. I don't know.
Did you all ever go to any of the open houses?
Not recently, no.
When Lou Tate was...
Oh, yeah. Well, tell about the open houses.
Well, it was just open house. Everybody was welcome. Everybody brought something. They were usually on Sunday afternoon. You came and left at your pleasure. There was pink lemonade was a favorite. And it was out on that, right outside the middle house.
Well, no, it was
the top house. Everybody knew everybody. You didn't need introductions. You just said, oh, how are you? And that was it. There were famous people and then just average people. Everybody was welcome. Everybody enjoyed it. She particularly liked children. She was a good teacher. And she demanded their respect and attention. And she said, no, you're not doing it that way. Hold it this way. No, that's wrong. This way. She was a good teacher. And they were well rewarded by her praise and the pink lemonade. And sometimes she'd take them up the hill and they would hunt for
fossils. They had fossils on the hill.
Well, that was different.
That place was probably water at one time. See, so it does have a history.
And there were a lot of boys. A lot of boys came.
She would tell stories of in the early days that the Indians would came through there too. See, that was Indian country, and of course I don't suppose she ever had any contact with them, but that was a story, you know.
I remember one time all of us had to do out there in the summertime. It was one of the first ones we went to. I'm glad you brought that up. She said, "Just come." And as we parked the car and trudged up the hill, there was a man sitting on a tree trunk or something, and he had a gun slung over his shoulder, and he had an old jacket on, you know, part of the thing.
Big corn cob pipe, and he's not about that long.
You know, everybody just one of those.
She'd have these dressed up things, you know, like that.
And every now and then, one of the men would come out of the woods, you know, looking like a pioneer.
She did all that sort of thing, and they had a nice time out there.
And everybody would bring something, would all be put on some boards, on some...
Sawhorse.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
It was not fancy.
It was all rough and ready, you know, that's the way she operated.
And you usually sat at an angle, you know, part of it was this way. And it was, there would be no two times alike.
You know, she had quite a few problems with the later years, you know, the water run down that hill and down to her underneath the house and tried to wash it away, and she had, you know, quite a few problems there with the courts trying to get something done, and it was kind of disappointing for her.
She was
eccentric. And
she was solid.
So that's something like that.
Personally.
When we first met Lou, I think it was 1948. That's a long time ago. And so we didn't have problems with Lou. She was always, she was...
Did your boys go to the open houses?
Once
in a
while.
They were little kids. They were down the hill to eat, you see.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of kids go out there, you know.
Yeah,
it was something unusual to go out there and see all those houses, you know, and all the things she had sitting around there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I understand that she had contacts with Indians.
Well, it was my impression that the few years before she died, she spent quite a bit of time in Florida with the Indians. Now, what the purpose was, I can't say because I don't know, but I'm positive that was the case. And she was gone for quite a while. She just locked up the house and left. No, that's the way she operated.
Maybe the Seminoles, but we're not sure.
We're not sure. Maybe the Seminoles, but I'm not positive about that.
And then, too, I recall, she had an invitation to visit a friend in Weber up in Cape Breton. And as it happened, we took the Cabot Trail, went up there one June. At that time, Lou was quite ill. And we talked by phone with the lady who had at one time visited Kentucky and the Loon House and had a very nice conversation with her. We were about 80 miles from where she lived, and 80 miles up there and back was a little far with our itinerary. And we enjoyed that. And then when we came home, while she was very, very ill and died shortly after that, which was about 6 or 7 years ago.
Concerning the Indians.
As I recall, when Lou was, probably before she got so involved with teaching weaving and at the Loom House, she spent some time in Florida living with an Indian group. It seems to me that we even saw pictures of her. And she did everything they did. She melted right in with them. And they accepted her. And I would think
she had Indian relics hanging around in the house.
I would think that being the type of person she was, she knew how to conduct herself as a guest of this group. And she was one of the Indian family for, I would say, maybe a few weeks during the summer. Just before we went up to Cape Breton, Roy and I went to see Lou Tate and tell her of our plans and get a little information about the person we were to contact. We got up there. And so we did that and had a nice conversation. And she intimated that she was looking forward to hearing what her friend had to say when we come back. She was rather expectant. And she had a little glass of violets that someone had brought her. And as I was going out the door, actually we told her goodbye and said, well, you'll hear from us now just as soon as we get back. She said, Dorothy, you take this little glass with you. And she picks the violets out and gave me the little glass. And it was and so that was our lesson to see Lou. We hope we'll see, or we'll see when we come back, and we'll have all the news from Cape Breton. I have a glass now in my china cabinet.
It's sitting behind the door. And I said, what the heck are you doing with this gun, Lou?
Mr. Heimerdinger has a gun.
And she said, and she said, you want that thing? I said, well, sure, I'll take that. So I became the proud owner. I don't know how old this thing is. It's an old gun. Holds about 5 shots. I have never shot it.
What kind of a gun is it?
That's a 22 rifle. A semi-automatic, I guess. Now I'm going to pull the trigger.
Mr. Heimerdinger did build the last 125 looms that were made for the Lou Tate Foundation Incorporated. This is the end of my interview with Roy and Dorothy Heimerdinger, Side 1, Take 1.